Hello, everyone. This is Larry Mishkin. Welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. My co-host, Rob Hunt of Linne Holdings, is here from California. Rob, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Larry. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing great. Kind of nasty and overcast here in Chicago, but that's winter here, so we just get used to it. But lots of great stuff going on music-wise, especially good stuff today for us to talk about with the Dead. In fact, I know that you've got a clip queued up here for the show we're going to talk about. You want to give it a quick intro?
Sure. I think what we're going to be talking about today is, you know, a little bit of this day in history. From 2/15/1973, we're going to listen to a little bit of the Dane County Coliseum. And I think we're going to start off today with a little bit of The Jam and Here Comes Sunshine, which had just come out right around this time. So, you know, maybe fire that one up for a second.
Great stuff, Rob. Great selection.
So yeah, and you know, that's coming off of Wake in the Flood, which was just about to be released. So this is predating it. A lot of the songs that were going on that album were being tested out. So, you know, the set list we're going to talk about today has quite a few of the songs, you know, from there, including, you know, Eyes of the World, Here Comes Sunshine, and a couple others. Good stuff. A good way to start the day off. I was lucky enough to catch the breakout of Here Comes Sunshine when they brought it back in Tempe, Arizona, I believe in December of 1992 or 1993. So a song that I never thought I'd see, and then all of a sudden, you know, got it coming back out, and it was actually, I got miracled that night into the front row, where the person that gave me the ticket said, "Hey, if I give you this ticket, you know, you serious? You have no money? You're sure?" I'm like, he's like, "What if I told you it's front row?" I'm like, "Doesn't change the fact that I can't give you anything, you know, for us." I'm like, "I'll get you really high, but, you know, that's about the most I can do." And they came back about 15 minutes later and gave me the ticket, and true to my word, I got them really, really high. So it was a lot of fun. But every time I hear that song, I think about that great day of coming down from Salt Lake City, where it's frigid cold, into the Phoenix heat, and having a couple of really fun days at I think it was Compton Terrace is where they had those shows.
Yep, and then later on, they came through Chicago that spring, and they played it at the lovely Rosemont Horizon. And, of course, I happened to be able to go that night with a good friend of ours.
I went those. Those are the Ken Nardine shows.
Yep. Good friend of ours, Alex Wellens, was in town, and he got to go to the show with me. And somehow Alex wound up down on the floor 10 rows back, and I wound up in the upper deck with my wife and other people, you know, and we all got to hear the Here Comes Sunshine, and it was great, but he was, like, right in front of Jerry. And, you know, Alex, as Jay can attest, is one of those kind of guys who can pull off that kind of stuff, and it's always fun to go to Grateful Dead shows with. But, yeah, this is just a collection of tremendous tunes, and I look forward to talking about it in a little while.
Well, Larry, you snuck it in there that we got a special guest today, so why don't you introduce him?
I'm going to do it right now. We do have a very special guest today, a very good friend of our show and a good friend of the Grateful Dead community as a whole, Jay Blakesburg, who is the official photographer of Dead & Company and quite a number of other bands of note. And Jay, welcome to our show again. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, that, you know, I'm a big fan of the 73 era of the Grateful Dead. You know, looking at that set list from this show where you just played that cut. And I always loved Here Comes Sunshine. I love listening to the studio album. I love listening to Wake of the Flood. I love that original pure Eyes of the World. Such a great record. You know, it's funny because, you know, I was up at Weir's house actually just a couple days ago. I was interviewing him for a documentary that I'm working on. And I was talking about Weather Report, and I was like, you know, when you put out that record in 73, the songs that were in the charts were like Olivia Newton-John and Tom Jones and Rod Stewart, you know, stuff like that, like 2 and 3 minute songs. And you put out this record that's got this 13 minute or whatever it is, you know, Weather Report. And I had him talk about, you know, asking him if he was listening to popular radio at the time, if that was an influence. And he said, yeah, he had been. Back then, he did listen to everything that was going on, but they just sort of followed their own muse. You know, like if they wanted to make a 13-minute song and put it on a record, that's sort of what they did. You know, you also have to remember that was it Wake of the Flood? Was that the first record that was on Grateful Dead Records? Was that the first release? Was it Wake of the Flood, Mars Hotel, and Blues for Allah? Are those the three Grateful Dead records that came out on Grateful Dead Records? So if it was, Wake of the Flood was the first one.
It is, and it was. You're spot on, Jay.
Yeah, and so, you know, they also didn't have to answer to, you know, Joe Smith at Warner Brothers or anything like that. They could you know, travel on their high frequency. And, you know, another interesting story, I recently connected with the guy who created Grateful Dead Records for the band. And he was a photographer back in the 60s and had like 1,000 photographs of the Grateful Dead from 67 to the early 70s that have been in storage for 55 years that nobody's ever seen, that I have recently rescued and scanned, and will make their debut sometime in the near future in some different projects that I'm working on. So, you know, Ron's a very elderly, great gentleman, and he trusted me to give me all these incredible photographs that when you see them, they will blow your mind. You know, another funny story, when I was up at Weir's place, you know, the documentary is about Deadheads and the war on drugs and me and the band. And, you know, Bobby, I said to him, I was asking him about how important the documentation by the tapers and photographers were, and, you know, and are going to be in telling the story of the band. And he was saying, you know, in 200 or 300 years, he believes, and I do too, that people will still want to know about the Grateful Dead. They will still be being talked about, right? As long as we don't do something stupid to blow our planet up. And so, you know, I was kind of going down this road of a photography kind of questioning to him. And I said, you know, Bobby, you know, you've said to me, you know, several times over the recent years, you know, oh, Jay, don't you have enough photos of me already? And I, when I said that to him, he laughed. And then I said, you know, I always wanted to say this back to you, Bob, but I always hold my tongue. And that is, haven't you played Me and My Uncle and Sugar Magnolia enough times? Right. And he laughed at that. And I said, listen, you know, every time you play those songs, you want them to be the best version you've ever played. Every time I take a new picture of you, I want it to be the best picture I've ever taken of you. And so that's why I don't have enough pictures of you, Bob, because I'm always trying to get a better photograph of you than the last one that I took. Like, you're always trying to play at Sugar Mag that's better than the last one. So he kind of laughed at that analogy.
Now, let me ask you, Jay, recently, though, didn't you have a chance to shoot Bobby and his daughter at the big formal that they go to?
Yeah, I did go to the debutante ball with the Weir family, and I guess a few of those, some videos maybe popped up with me in the background that his other daughter, Monet, posted. So, but you know, that's sort of like personal stuff that they do with their family. So I probably don't really want to talk about it. You know, like, I haven't posted any photos from it, but let's just say it was a really very cool, elegant evening with tuxedos and ball gowns and
white gloves
and white gloves.
I love Bobby with the white gloves. That's all I'm going to say.
And Bob did a great job, and Chloe did a great job, and they did their debutante coming out, and I was there to photograph it all. So, you know, it was a lovely evening.
Well, mazel tov to the Weirs. That's very exciting. That's a good time.
I got to say, going back to what you were saying earlier, I certainly hope that, you know, Bobby was listening to Tom Jones back then, because you can't really beat What's New Pussycat back in 1973. So, you know.
Right. Well, also, you know, did you ever see the clip of Tom Jones sitting with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? On the Tom Jones go on YouTube and watch it. It's amazing. It's, you know, Tom Jones, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young and Jones, you know, and definitely worth checking out, you know, so easy to find on YouTube. But yeah, you know, great music, you know. Of course, Tom Jones was unbelievable, you know. What's not to like about Tom Jones?
Yeah, if you ever get a chance, the John Mulaney, the comedian, does a great bit about What's New Pussycat that's absolutely hilarious, where he and his buddy go into a diner and play that song over and over and over again on a jukebox, like 20 times in a row, until people start to lose their minds. And then, just to really get them, he plays one, It's Not Unusual, to throw it in there, just to mix it up. And everyone's like, oh, thank God, there's no more What's New Pussycat. And then he puts back What's New Pussycat for like the next 20 songs. And the bit, if you're a John Mulaney fan, is absolutely, it's funnier than the whole Trump, like, horse in the hospital bit. It's amazing.
Sounds pretty funny. I don't know that. I'll have to go and look for that on YouTube. That sounds like a good one. But yeah, this 73 show looks pretty stellar. You know, got a nice Eyes of the a Dark Star Eyes of the World China doll. You know, that's pretty smoking. You know, and Uncle John's band, of course, Here Comes Sunshine. Great first set with Bertha playing, China Rider, Road Jimmy, Draft Straw.
Let me ask you this. You know, one of the things that drew me to this tape early on and you know, kind of taught me the significance of different eras of Dead is that for some reason, 1973 only, they play this up-tempo version of They Love Each Other. Have you ever, but it just seems they only play it in 73. And then from that point forward, it's always back to the more traditional version.
Right. A little bit slower. Yeah.
Right. And I never understood what motivated him to do it just because I love that up-tempo version.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that either.
And they play the China Riders without the crescendo and the transition jam.
Right.
The missing crescendo.
But I'll tell you what else I really like about this is You Ain't Woman Enough, right? Because it's like such a great song for Donna to sing that's, you know, I think really well suited for her. And she belts it out really well. And I love that song on there. That's always one of the highlights of that tape.
Yeah, I got to go check it out. I can't even picture that song in my head. So
Well, lucky for us, we have a clip of it. So Dan, you want to pop in just a quick segment of that as well? Straight Honky Tonk Garcia.
I was just going to say, it's like a honky tonk version of Jerry Garcia. It's awesome. I love that. And I love it. That's Tammy Wynette's tune, isn't it?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
Donna, but it's, you know, I mean, I know people have their feelings about Donna, and, you know, I don't love everything she does. I recognize the significance she played in Grateful Dead history, but I love it when they play a cover tune just for her. And she just, you know, and Jerry's back there jamming away and she's belting it out. I love that.
Yeah, of all the things that she was singing as a song just by herself, that's one of my favorites from that era. And I can't think they played it more than probably 7 or 8 times, maybe less.
That's always the problem. You know, they get these great tunes and, you know, they play them a few times and boom, they're gone. But, you know, it was fun for her and it was always fun to listen to. And I think that all the women deadheads out there always appreciated, you know, a good Donna tune thrown in like that every now and then just to show the feminine side of the Grateful Dead, as it were. Now, Jay, do you ever have any dealings with Donna?
Not really anything super close. I mean, obviously photographed her, and she sat in with Dead & Co. a couple summers back at a couple of stadium shows.
I remember.
And, you know, we chatted a little bit, but, you know, I don't really know Donna. She doesn't really know me, but, you know, I was a fan of some of the stuff that she did, you know, back in the day. It was, you know, some cool stuff. You know, I started my Grateful Dead trajectory in the Keith and Donna years, you know, saw the band only the first time I saw the Jerry Garcia band before the Grateful Dead, and that was with Keith and Donna in the band. Then English Town, and then Giant Stadium, and then the Capitol Theater, 11/24/78, the Deadhead only show where Garcia had the flu and laryngitis. There might have been one other show. No, that might be it. I might have only seen Keith and Donna 3 times.
So you saw JGB before you saw the Grateful Dead. Where did you see JGB?
Asbury Park Convention Hall.
So you grew up in Jersey then?
Yeah, July of 77. Yeah, I'm a Jersey boy, man.
Awesome. So did you catch any of those DC shows in 78? Did you catch like Warner Theaters or any of that stuff?
No. I mean, 78, I was still... You know, I was 15, 16, you know, I was still a youngster. My birthday's late. I'm a December baby. So December 78, I turned 17.
So you saw English Town as a 16-year-old?
As a 15-year-old.
That's sick.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
As a first show, yeah, pretty decent.
Yeah, a lot of people. First show for a lot of East Coast, you know, metropolitan area deadheads. You know, Philly, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut deadheads. It was the English Town was the first for sure.
Well, that was like the only show they played out there that summer, wasn't it? They worked on the East Coast a lot.
Yeah, you know, if you remember, you know, Mickey had a car accident shortly before English Town, and Donna had some sort of surgery. You know, Donna sits on a stool for most of English Town, and Mickey had, if I remember correctly, I think Phil told me this story. Mickey drove his car into a tree, but not like into a tree, but into like the branches of the tree up high, like off like a raised area with a tree down below, like a driveway that was along a big slope, and this Porsche like ended up in a tree or something like that. He dislocated
it. Like John Candy in the Blues Brothers launching into the truck.
Yeah, something like that, if I remember correctly. But so there were some injuries, but I mean, you know, for anybody who's hasn't listened to ever or in a long time, you know, English Town 77, just go put on the He's Gone, Not Fade Away jam. You know, it's, I believe it's 40 minutes long. You know, I think each of them clock in at like 18 or 19 minutes, something like that. But the transition jam in between that He's Gone, Not Fade Away is beyond epic. It is probably one of my most, and I didn't realize it at the time when I was 15, but probably one of my most favorite pieces of live Grateful Dead music. And there obviously are so many incredible ones out there. But, you know, if you haven't given it a listen in a while, that He's Gone, Not Fade Away, that is stellar, mind-boggling stellar.
So I'm still trying to come to terms with the fact that you saw a JGB show before you saw a Grateful Dead show. Because I saw my first JGB show after four times of seeing the Grateful Dead. So I saw my first Dead in September of 88, and I saw my first Garcia band on September 5th, 89.
Right. So I guess you're not as cool as me? Is that what you're saying?
No, but definitely. That goes without saying. I'm not as cool as anyone, right? But more to the point, like, I didn't know any of, like, JGB, like, tunes. Like, when I first went to see JGB, I just assumed that he was going to play, like, you know, Half Dead songs. And it was a brand new experience. And ultimately, I became a much bigger Garcia band fan than I was even a Grateful Dead fan. You know, but, like, I didn't miss JGB shows after, like, 93.
Sugary was the only song I knew.
Yeah, I mean, Deal was the only song I knew, right? It was, other than that, it was...
Right, maybe I knew Deal also, and I think they played it at that show. But, you know, I had a friend who was, you know, the same age as my brother and sister, so 2 years older than me, and his name was Lozzy, L-O-Z-Y, you know, that was his nickname, because everybody had nicknames in the 1970s. When you smoked a lot, as much pot and did as much acid as we did, you had to have a nickname. And anyway, so his mission in life was to turn me on to music. And he took me and I think Nikki Katsanis, maybe one other person, down in his Carmen Ghia to Asbury Park. I didn't drive. I was 15, but he was 17. He had a car. And he got the tickets. They were front row seats all the way over to the side in front of Keith. But and we brought a camera. I don't know whose camera. It had a 50-millimeter lens. And we passed it around, and we all took some photos on it. We got back and developed the roll of film and went into a dark room at another friend's from high school's house. And we got two photos that were almost in focus and almost exposed properly. And we made some 5x7s and thumbtacked them to our bedroom wall. And I watched Jerry come up in that magical, mystical, cancerous developer, and I was hooked forever, you know, at that very moment.
And that was the July 9th, 1977 show, is that right?
Or
was
yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
That's, okay, I'm looking at the list now, it's sick. The Heart of the Come opener, it's looks really good.
Did they play Deal that night?
I'm not seeing it. The list I'm seeing right now is A Harder They Come, Midnight Moonlight, Russian Lullaby, Tore Up, Knockin', Tangled, Not Fade Away, is what I'm seeing. But let me see if I can get the whole thing.
Is there a Sugary in the second set?
Yeah. There's a Sugary that actually opened the first set. Sugary, Stop That Train, That's What Love Will Make You Do, Simple Twist, Sitting in Limbo, Mystery Train, How Sweet It Is.
Yeah, I remember the Tangled Up in Blue also, because we were like, oh my God, he's playing a Bob Dylan song, you know, and
well, I figure you know the Jimmy Cliff tunes as well, right? But the Sitting in Limbo and A Harder They Come.
Yeah, probably Harder They Come for sure. Maybe Sitting in Limbo. You know, again, we were 15, right? So we were, you know, we were limited to what we heard on the radio or what we had in records or what our siblings had in records. And, you know, so, you know, we didn't have the type of music that we have today at our fingertips.
No, same. The first time I saw the Garcia band in 83, I think the only tune he played that I knew was Dear Prudence, right? You know, everything else was, I was like, wow, I didn't even realize there was this whole side of Garcia Away from the Dead. And, you know, that was an eye-opener.
Right. Yeah, we used to joke back in those days that, you know, Jerry would start doing a solo. He could go, you know, go to the bathroom, get a beer, or come back, and he'd still be playing the same solo.
But I never wanted to miss the damn solo.
That's why I love Garcia Band. You know, there's nothing else to a Split Away.
Of course, but that's why I never went. That's why I never went to the bathroom nor got a beer, because I didn't want to miss that solo. But
that's why I never missed a Warfield show. You know, when I realized I could like get my dinner and then stand, you know, 5 feet away from Garcia and just watch licks all night, where like I didn't have to worry. Like the only thing that you might get is that it got passed over to Melvin for a few minutes. You know, and that to me was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah, for sure.
So Jay, tell us about Playing in the Sand. You made it down there.
I did make it down there, you know, because I work down there. I do, in a normal year, I shoot for the band, obviously. And I also do my slideshow, my Grateful Dead slideshow storytelling presentation. And I also set up a photo gallery as like an attraction for the fans to come in and check out, you know, cool art, another thing to do. CID is very gracious to host me with all of that.
Yes, can I ask, is that Berka that's setting that up with you, or is that
originally it was Berkowitz, but Berkowitz is no longer involved in CID, so, but still a dear friend, and love Dan and miss Dan very much. But anyway, so, you know, I got down there a couple days early because I have to prep and get ready and, you know, dial things in. And so I was there when everybody else got the news on that same day, and, you know, saw all the rumors on the internet that, you know, a bunch of people posted that, you know, probably should just shut up. But, you know, people have that addiction to social media and feel like they have to be the first to tell something. And, you know, I was sad and shocked and, you know, upset. But listen, they tried to do a large scale concert in the middle of a global pandemic, and we all knew the risks and we all knew the rewards, and unfortunately the risks outweighed the rewards this time. And you know, the band or CID or Together or whoever it was, I don't really even know, you know, decided in the interest of the health and safety and welfare of the fans and the band and the crew and the staff that Playing in the Sand couldn't happen, you know. So I think once that initial shock wore off from everybody that was already there, you know, there were people coming into from the airport still. There were people at the airport. I know some people that just like immediately heard about it and they went to, you know, somewhere else. They went to Cozumel, or, you know, they went and rented an Airbnb somewhere. They just stayed in Cancun or whatever. But, you know, the people that were on site, we all were very sad and bummed out. And then we just started moving forward and said, all right, let's enjoy each other's company and let's make, you know, lemonade out of lemons. And CID set up this, you know, this year the venue was cool. So they moved it to the other side of the beach, and then the venue came down the beach, and then it jogged off into this little courtyard area between two of the housing buildings over at the Sunshine Resort. And so it was all fenced in. So it was part of it. And they had craft beer and craft cocktails and craft churros and craft burritos and snacks and tacos, and, you know, and they also had a giant video screen there with a killer sound system. So actually, you know, if the show had gone on and you wanted to hang out in that area and not be on the beach, you had a video screen that was, you know, 15 feet across by 15 feet high or whatever. And, you know, full on sound system, you know, concert grade sound system. So you could, you know, get away from the beach or whatever and still see it and hear it. And so that's where my gallery was going to be this year. And, you know, we packed everything up at first, and we took everything out of frames and put it back in boxes and, you know, called it a day, and then started talking to the guest services people. And they were like, maybe you should do your gallery. Let's, you know, maybe people would be enjoy it. And they were going to start like showing videos on those screens on that first week. You know, they were going to try and do some programming. And so they were getting some live music that they were, you know, pumping through the sound system, and people were dancing and hanging out and having craft beers and craft cocktails. And I had my gallery open, so people got to come in and check out some artwork. And then I said to the guest service, and then a lot of people started saying to me, are you going to still do your slideshow? Well, my slideshow is scheduled to happen indoors, and we didn't feel like it would be safe to do it indoors. So there are a couple of outdoor stages by a couple of the pools at the Nizuc Resort is where like the late night bands would be playing. And at the Sunshine Pool, there's a stage with a giant screen. And I said, can we do it outside there. I bet you people would love to come. And so, you know, they talked to the hotel and they got the projector out there and they set it up. And an hour before I was supposed to start, it started pouring rain for 15 minutes and my laptop almost fried. And we got it dialed in and, you know, 300-400 people showed up and I got to do my slideshow. And so, you know, people got to have a little bit of Grateful Dead energy. And then at the end of it, I joked that I thanked everybody for letting me headline Playing in the Sand.
No, that's great. And I got to tell you, I could think of a lot worse fates than being stuck for a week in Mexico with a bunch of deadheads and, you know, being able to go and like see some. My kid a few years ago drove out to to see Curveball up in upstate New York for Fish. And they canceled the show as they were driving into the parking lot. Nobody let them hang out. They had to get the hell out of there and go home.
Yeah, well, they let you hang out, and the NCID paid for your room. Like, you basically, except for your flights and your, you know, your ground transportation back in the States, you essentially got a free vacation, and you could stay, if you had a five-night package, you could stay for 5 nights. If you had a two-week package, you could stay for 2 weeks. You could do whatever you want. So they were very generous. It was all very sad and terrible, but CID, you know, there was a lot of bashing at first. Because there's a lot of grumpy deadheads who hide behind computers. And a lot of the bashing came from people that weren't even there, or weren't even going, because that's what we always see online. And I have to say that, you know, the CID people did everything that they could to still try and make a good event or a good experience for the fans. And I tip my glass to them because they really care about their customers. You know, they're not like a fly by night organization that's just like a, you know, go screw yourself. They really care about their customers and they did what they could to do the right thing. You know, there's nobody to blame. CID is not to blame. The band is not to blame. The band members is not to blame. The global pandemic is what is to blame, and there's nothing that anybody can do about it.
So we were right to assume then that it was CID that ultimately made the decision and not the band itself.
I don't know the answer to that. I think it was a joint decision, but I don't really know. I don't really know the answer to that question, unfortunately.
But it was the right decision, you think?
Boy, was it the right decision? Well, yeah, John had COVID, so that played a part. Billy was still having health issues. I'm not the one to say if it was the right decision or the wrong decision, because obviously widespread panic played in Mexico a couple weeks later, and Wilco and Brandi Carlile and, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish and all these other shows are happening. But you have to remember that when we were there in Mexico that first week in January, that was the peak of Omicron. Okay. And there were still unknowns about Omicron, how bad it was, how much it was going to affect you, whether it was long-term, whether people were going to get sick, whether people were going to get hospitalized. You know, you're in a foreign country and nobody wants that liability. Nobody wants, you know, and our fan base, you know, look at all of us on this Zoom here. We're all like, you know, combined, we're like 1,000 years old, right? You know, the four of us.
Well, maybe Dan, I don't know.
Right. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the fan base in general is people that are 50 and up. And, you know, we're at risk at our age for COVID. And so, you know, the health and welfare of the audience was important. Again, I don't know who actually decided to cancel it, and it doesn't matter. We were, you know, in Mexico at the peak of the pandemic or that variant, the Omicron, and somebody had to make a call, and that was the call they made. And, you know, and we all have to live with it because there's no going back.
Do you do any of the other shows down there? Do you do any of the Cloud Nine Presents events?
I don't do any of the Cloud Nine stuff now. And no, just Dead & Co. It's the only one that I've done so far. So,
hey, Jay, is there any insight you know or you can share with us about Billy's health and how he's doing?
I mean, just what everybody else knows. You know, I hear he's doing okay. You know, I'm sure he's taking it slow. I'm sure he's not out there, you know, rehearsing or pounding on, you know, the drums every day. I'm sure he's trying to get as healthy as he possibly can so that he can continue to play music for many, many more years, which is what we all want. We want Bill Kreutzmann to be healthy. You know, that's really that's the bottom line, is that, you know, these guys can get out there and play more music together, because we all want it. We all miss it. And we all want to experience it.
How do you feel that Dead & Co. is playing right now? When was the last time you heard them?
I guess at the Hollywood Bowl, Halloween. You know, I saw one show on the East Coast, the tour opener in Raleigh, and then I saw the tour closer in the first half at Wrigley, both great nights. And then I saw Maybe was it just the tour closer at the Hollywood Bowl? Oh, and then at Red Rocks, of course, I went to Red Rocks. I had a great time. I thought they were playing great. I thought that Jay Lane did an amazing job of stepping in. Do you guys remember the story early on in around 2016, early on in Dead & Co, where Bob did an interview maybe with Billboard or somebody, and he talked about how he had this vision where he was floating above the band, behind the band, and he's looking down, and there were different musicians, and there was different players, and different drummers, and different, you know, front person singing his songs. And he, you know, it's funny because I did a photo shoot with Bob a few weeks before that interview, and he told me that same story in the photo shoot. And then, you know, he told it publicly, I think it was Billboard or Polestar, one of those. And essentially, that's what Bob and these guys think, is that this movie, this music lives on with Dead & Co, you know, with a revolving cast. Maybe, you know, maybe Bill Kreutzmann retires at some point and the other band members don't. And maybe Jay Lane becomes a member. Then maybe Bob retires and somebody else replaces him. But John and O'Teal and Jeff are still there. And, you know, maybe O'Teal moves on. And, you know, who knows what? Like, you know, it's all... You know, but I think that the songbook, as we all know, is legendary, and it will continue on with all sorts of different tributes, and hopefully Dead & Co will continue on as well. But, you know, the bowl shows were great. Everything I saw, I loved every minute of it.
Did you happen to catch any of the Phil shows at the Capitol Theater in October?
I did not, because I was too busy with stuff on the West Coast, including Dead & Co. And it was just too crazy, and I couldn't get to the East Coast. It was the first cap shows I've missed in a while.
Yeah, I was at the first three nights with the quintet, and
yeah, I mean, I was so sad to miss the quintet,
just,
but
you know, I mean, every time I see them, it just blows me away. I mean, you know, a tremendous experience, a lot of fun to see those guys, and I was really glad to have a chance to get out there. One other quick question for you: what's your thoughts on this new Scorsese project and Jonah Hill playing Jerry?
I think that I should play Jim Marshall in the movie. Do you know who Jim Marshall is?
Has anybody approached you for that yet?
No. You know who Jim Marshall was?
Photographer.
Yeah, legendary photographer. You know, shot the Live Dead photo on, you know, the Hate Street photo.
He shot the Johnny Cash photo. The iconic flipping you off, yeah. It's one of the great ones.
Yeah, the Johnny Cash flipping the bird. Yeah. No, nobody's approached me. Sure. Cool. Great. Can't wait to see it. Let's see what happens. You know, I mean, I have no idea. But yeah, you know, I think it'll be interesting. You know, like the Elton John biopic is great and the Queen one was great. And so hopefully they won't mess this one up. And it'll be cool and interesting, you know, to see Jonah Hill play young Jerry Garcia.
Does Bobby have any thoughts on it?
I didn't ask him. I have no idea.
Oh. Okay.
No idea. So we'll see. But yeah, should be interesting. And hopefully it'll all happen. Who knows? You know, these things take a long time to, I don't know if they even have a screenplay yet. So
I'm guessing most of those decisions were made by Red Light and by Trixie and Annabelle.
For that movie?
Yeah.
I don't see that being true.
You think they would approach the band to
They had to approach the band. It's not a Jerry Garcia biopic. It's a Grateful Dead biopic. The band had to agree. It can't just be the Garcia estate. I mean, if it's a Garcia documentary, then it would be Trixie and Annabelle and Red Light Management. But no, if it's the Grateful Dead, it's Bob and Phil and Mickey and Bill and
an activist.
Yeah, you know, it's their decision, not just the Garcia estate on the at least that's what I would think.
We've been pontificating over here who's going to get the nod for all the other featured roles. You know, obviously Jonah's been announced, but you know, for us it was like, who's going to get all the other supporting cast roles? There's going to be probably some really cool ones.
Right, Woody Harrelson is Bob Weir.
Is he?
No, I don't know.
He could pull it off.
Right. I have pictures of Woody Harrelson singing with Bob Weir on stage at a 420 Earth Day gig in San Francisco, a free concert back in, I don't know, mid-2000s.
Well, today, Dan this week sent around a clip of a very clean-shaven and tuxedoed Bob Weir playing with Chuck Berry at his introduction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I saw that.
I love seeing that, you know, but he's kind of trying to figure out what his place is on the stage. And you know, Chuck defers to him and let him jam for a few minutes. I thought it was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
Doesn't Woody live, like, right next door to Bill down in Maui?
No idea.
For some reason, I think those two have houses like really close to each other.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
So tell, what's your next big project, Jay?
So, well, I was just going to say, I got to jump here because I got to get on a call here shortly. So I'm just finishing up a new book. During the pandemic, well, I got two things. One is the documentary film, which is what I mentioned earlier, and we're very far along on that. And my son is directing that, and I'm producing it. And I did all the interviews, and you know, we interviewed Mickey for it also, and some other interesting people. I won't give too much away, but hard at work on the documentary. And my daughter, Ricky, during the pandemic, she asked if she could start a new Instagram page for me called Retro Blakesburg. And Retro Blakesburg's premise is that it's only photographs that I shot on film. And she curates it 100%. She, you know, she does it. I don't have any input into it. She won't let me have any input in it. Every once in a while, I suggest a photo that would be cool. And she usually tells me to go fuck myself. But she says it in a polite way because I'm her father. So, oh, Dad, go fuck yourself. So somewhere along the way in the pandemic, she said, why don't we do a book on Retro Blakesburg? So we have a new book coming out called Retro Blakesburg, The Film Archives, Volume 1. And it's a big book. It's 312 pages. Wayne Coyne from The Flaming Lips wrote the foreword. Michael Fronte wrote the introduction. I wrote some extended, it's broken up by decades. So I wrote a 2000 word essay for the 70s, the 80s. And then I think my 90s and 2000 essays are about 1500 words each. So I wrote a good 7,000 words for the book. And then, it's got a lot of photographs in it with some captions. And then I wrote some extended captions on some stuff. And, we're going to hopefully send that to the printer in about 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow.
I've been working on it for a year and a half.
Nice.
And it's finally ready to, you know, we were waiting on the foreword and the introduction from Michael Fronte and Wayne Coyne. Cause you know, those musicians, you know, musicians always take a little bit longer to get things done. And especially when they're doing them as favors for people like me. But they did get them done. And my next call that I got to do here shortly is with my editor, who is doing the final edit proofreading of my 2000s essay, which is the last element for the book. And then we will put it into pre-press and get it all dialed in. And it will go to the printer. And it will come out officially, I guess the release date will be sometime in September of 2022.
Can people pre-order?
Not yet. Not on the website yet. We're going to do a limited edition version of the book, and that will be able to pre-order. That will probably be the only one that people will pre-order. And so this is way, way advanced publicity because this podcast will be airing soon.
Will you let us know when it comes out so we can pump it up on the show and let people know to go pick it up?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, I'll come back on and I'll talk to anybody. I'll be a complete media whore and talk to everybody about my book. But the other...
I was going to say, if you're dying to send an autographed copy to anyone, you know, you've got welcome recipients on the other end of this podcast. So
I have a couple of Jay Blakesburg autographed books sitting in my living room right now.
I do too. I've got one right there.
One per media outlet. So you guys are going to have to like fight in like the lion's den over it to the death.
Larry always kicks my ass. I can't win that right fight.
And then the other book that I'm working on right now is I'm doing a book called Illegal Images, The History of Blotter Acid Art. And I'm doing that with a guy named Mark McLeod, who owns the Blotter Acid Art Museum here in San Francisco. Also called the Institute of Illegal Images. And we are making a coffee table book on the history of blotter art. So that's another big project. That one will, in theory, come out in the fall of 2023. So a year after Retro Blakesburg will be fall 2022. And then for the fall of 2024, I'm going to put out another Grateful Dead project that I'm just starting to get into. But it's going to involve and include mostly unseen or rarely seen photographs of the Grateful Dead. And believe it or not, you know, like, because everybody's seen all my photos of the Dead and Bob Minkins and Ed Perlstein's and Herbie Green and Jim Marshall. I've been reaching out to people and finding old collections of Grateful Dead photographs that have been sitting in attics and basements for decades and decades. You know, like you might have brought a camera to a show in college in 74 and took some pictures and you found your negatives or your slides, and I want them, and we're going to put them in this book. I just about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, the Jerry Garcia Instagram page and the Grateful Dead Instagram and Facebook pages, they posted a photograph of David Crosby jamming with the Grateful Dead at the Fillmore West in August of 1970. And that photograph came from me. And I discovered an archive of a woman named Elizabeth Sunflower. And I'm working with that archive now. And with my daughter, and I discovered that photo and I sent it to David Crosby's archivist. And he's like, oh my God, who gets to release this to the world? And I said, go ahead and send it out as a tweet. And he tweeted it and everybody picked it up and it got a lot of attention. So we're finding stuff like that. So the Instagram for that stuff is on Instagram only is Retro Photo Archive, at Retro Photo Archive. And we're just starting to post stuff on there. So things like that from the Elizabeth Sunflower Archive, and some of this other stuff that we're discovering and finding in long-lost crevices will end up on Retro Photo Archive. And that website will pop up in about maybe 6 or 8 weeks, the Retro Photo Archive website, retrophotoarchive.com.
When the recent St. Louis box set came out, a story got out of St. Louis was popularized of the Dead showing up at a bar mitzvah at a hotel that was right across the street. And we were lucky enough to get one of the band members who had been playing there to come over and on the show. And, you know, he was outlining the whole experience to us, and it was amazing. But I thought of you, and I'm like, photographs, there's got to be photographs. Turns out the bar mitzvah boy's mother had a whole box full of photographs, and her house burned down. She had photographs of all of it, of all of them up there. They were all there in there except for Garcia. This was what, vintage 71 or 72 Grateful Dead.
So that St. Louis box set, there are 6 photos, I believe, in it by a photographer named Alvin Meyerowitz, which are also part of my Retro Photo Archive. And I was the one who got them from Alvin, also an archive that had been sitting dormant. He's a 80-year-old man in San Francisco. And I got his photographs and got them to Rhino, and Rhino used 6 of them in that St. Louis box set. So so that's you know, some of the projects I'm working on is trying to find these archives of people that shot photographs. So a guy named Mark Jaffe, which is funny because my stepbrother's name is Mark Jaffe, but a guy named Mark Jaffe contacted me out of the blue, and he had a roll of color film that he shot in the Dead in, I think, 81 in Pittsburgh, and the Garcia Band in 80 in New Jersey, and sent me the color slides and said, you know, they're just collecting dust at my house. Why don't you store them and archive them and scan them? And I scanned about 8 or 10 of those shots, and, you know, they're fun, cool, you know, moment in history that otherwise would have just been sitting in a slide box with nobody to enjoy them ever. So they'll end up on the Retro Photo Archive Instagram page also.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Jay, thank you so much for your time today. And even the few extra minutes you've given us here, you are a busy guy. We appreciate the time and all the information you share with us. We will look forward to seeing these books when they come out. And you're always welcome to come on anytime and promote the hell out of them. We love that too, and that'll be a lot of fun. At the end of this month, I'm going to be in Southern Cal with Alex and Andy and others, and we always have a good time sitting outside around a fire with a big fatty of the new Garcia strain, which I think is really, really good, telling Jay's stories. So I look forward to that as well.
All right. Well, I'm having dinner with Andy and Alex tonight. For those of you that are wondering who this mysterious Andy and Alex are, they're old Deadhead friends of Larry and maybe Rob. I don't know. It sounds like you knew Alex also back in the day. But they're my neighbors here in San Francisco, and we've known them for, my wife and Alex have known each other for 40 years, and I've known Andy and Alex. Andy is the girl, Alex is the boy.
In fact, she was the first guest we ever had on this podcast.
Yeah, we've had Andy on. She's terrific.
Yeah, and Andy has a cannabis business here in San Francisco, and she is the exclusive distributor in San Francisco for the Garcia strain, the hand-picked Garcia thing. So, yeah, so we're going over there for dinner tonight, so I'll tell them you guys said hi.
Please do.
And not that I, you know, I see them every day walking the dog anyway. So I can say hi today, tomorrow, the next day.
That's the nice thing.
Anyway, well thanks for having me on, and thanks for not smoking so much weed that you couldn't talk, you know, on the show, because this is the Deadhead Cannabis Show, and I know you guys just sit around puffing big vape pens and joints all day long and do nothing else with your lives. You're basically... Right. You know, like old stoners. And I will. And of course, you guys know I'm joking, even though Larry's lighting up. But and full disclosure here, I have not smoked marijuana since 1981. So thanks for having me on the Deadhead Cannabis Show. from a non-cannabis user. And love you guys, and peace out, and thanks for having me. We'll catch you next time.
You got it, Jay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. That was amazing having Jay on. It's the first time I've actually been on the show when Jay has been a guest, so I've been looking forward to that for quite some time. It's nice to have a guest back up here, Larry. It's been a while since we've started doing guests. We've got quite a few lined up, I think, for the next couple of weeks. Should we talk some weed? Should we talk what's going on in the cannabis world?
We should, but I just want to circle back on that and say you're right. Jay Blakesburg is just a treat because, you get guests on, sometimes you have to prompt him and this and that. And boy, Jay just, he starts and he dives right in. And the good part is everything he says is what at least I as a deadhead always want to hear about. So, anytime we can get him on the show and we can get him going like that, that's a real win for us. So I'm really happy for us and for our listeners. And good luck with all of his books. And they're all great. If you haven't bought any of them yet, you should, because they're all fantastic. And I'm sure these new ones will be really good.
Yeah, I was actually flipping through one of his books, while we were speaking here at the end of having him on. And so many great pictures from the Fairly Well book that he did of the five nights between Levi's Stadium and in Chicago. But I was telling him before we started the podcast today that quite a few shots of friends of mine, and there's a couple shots that I absolutely love of a lot of the guys I worked with in the music industry that are all together in one spot. There's one of Benji Eisen and Mark from Red Light and Pete Shapiro and Dan Berkowitz and you name it down the line, all in one picture together. Which is, Don Strasberg from AEG Live out in Colorado. But it's great when you get an opportunity to get all the people in the industry into one room at the same time where, none of them ever get to hang out together because they're all in different regions. That once in a while something is so big, just the magnitude so large that it pulls them all together to go, we got to be at that one.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely right. And, and it's great that you can capture those images. But I have to tell you, I'm not going to be able to wait till 2023 or 4, whatever it is, for that Blotter Acid art book. I want to see that. That's going to be something, I have to tell you.
Well, we can always raid Jim's fridge, if we want the advance.
Well, okay, maybe so. But, back in the day, to me, that was always half the fun was what was the design on the blotter, and some blotter was great. You get these great designs. And
well, do you remember the album covers? The album covers used to be the best. Where
we never got album covers.
Instead of obviously if you buy a sheet, that's 100 hits. But if you actually buy a full page, it was the 1,000 hits that had the border and everything around it. There was ones that had the full album covers of classic, Hendrix and Stones and Beatles. There was someone was putting out blotter paper in the mid to late 80s. That was just, these massive album covers right around the same time that Goonie Birds and the Blue Jets were popular. But super, super cool.
Those I did not see, but we saw them all from the Orange Sunshine and Felix the Cat and just on and on and on. It was always fun. It was always very interesting. Just, oh, Felix, okay, thanks, and off you go. So cool. That'll be a fun book.
Yep. Well, I don't think it's nearly as prevalent as it used to be. So I'm glad that someone's actually doing a retro on it, but. Compared to the days of the mid 80s where, doses were a buck a piece in the lot, those days are so gone at this point. And I think the whole jam band scene's moved on to Molly.
I think that's true. Judging from the folks who go to those shows that I know, not naming any names. Although I'm surprised because I still see a little bit of this younger generation, let's just call it, where a lot of them still do enjoy acid.
If they can find it, yeah. So I don't think it's a question of desire. I think it's a question of accessibility. It used to be that, you'd know guys would have, grams of needlepoint fluff that were laying out sheets and bathtubs in hotel rooms. And, I haven't heard and seen that in years.
No, that's true. Not at all like that. But, I think like anything else, it to the extent it makes it here to the Midwest, it probably tends to mostly flow out of the New York area. But, who knows? That's I guess that's where you have to go these days.
Well, hey, now that psychedelics are all getting legalized after cannabis, the next battleground, so they say. We'll see whether or not it happens. I'm not nearly as bullish on that as I was about cannabis legalization. But hey, let's talk about legalization because we got some big news maybe this week. I don't know. Again, the sixth time the House has passed the Safe Banking Act, and this time I feel like it's like a bad Hollywood sequel. It's like Safe Six. This time it's different.
It's still produced by Ed Perlmutter.
Exactly. Yeah. This time you've got Perlmutter, as we discussed previously, saying this is his last dying wish before he leaves the House. But and you've got, you know, Schumer now coming out saying that, you know, he's going to put out legalization, you know, new legislation on 420, and you've already got McConnell coming back going, oh, well, you know, there's a major issue with overdoses from, you know, from opiates, and the Democrats' response is to legalize cannabis. You know, okay, it's like whatever nonsense, you know, twist or spin that McConnell wants to put on anything that he does, you know, this one is slamming the Dems for doing something that actually had massive bipartisan support. So, you know, we'll see. But I spent some time with an investor in the space named Todd Harrison. I'll plug Todd for saying he's a pretty well-known investor in the space, and he's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on. And I spent a day in a car with him last week, and he's spending a lot of time on this effort. And, you know, when it came up, what did I think, you know, as far as legalization? I just shot it down unequivocally saying there's, you know, it's not going to happen. He's like, this time I think this time is different. I think you're wrong. And, you know, a day later, sure enough, they did pass it. But, you know, still remains to be seen whether or not this is going to get tacked on. So I mean, we've beaten this horse to death. So, you know, I think the idea at this point is let's just wait and see. But is there anything worth discussing about Schumer's new bill? Or, you know, do you think it's doomed to die the same slow, painful death that every other Senate bill that's out there is?
I don't think that any bill that's put forth by a Democrat has a chance of passing right now, so long as the Democrats don't have a clear veto-proof majority in the Senate. You know, they can't stop a filibuster, and so as long as they can't stop a filibuster, McConnell, you know, he's the classic politician. You know, we even see it on his comments on Trump, and not to focus on that very much, but, you know, he speaks a tune entirely different than what the rest of the Republican Party is speaking. And on the one hand, we can certainly praise him and say, thank God somebody's telling the truth. On the other hand, for him, it's all about business. And, you know, that he's just looking to...
And 13 months and 2 days late.
Well, there's that too, of course. I won't deny that. Right. But you know, look, it's a shame. And, you know, I think there's ways for McConnell to say no, thank you, without, you know, getting into all this, you know, nonsense about, you know, trying to pollute people's minds with marijuana. You know, we're a little beyond that, Mitch. And, you know, he knows this because he was a big proponent of the Farm Bill of 2018 that completely legalized hemp and all of its constituent cannabinoids. And guess what? One of the constituent cannabinoids in hemp is THC.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So, by the way, Mitch, you already legalized cannabis. You just didn't realize you were doing it. But thanks for that.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, he'll. It's just Mitch being Mitch. But I think that the answer is not right now. And I just don't see how it forges a path through the Senate as long as, you know, they can't even agree on what day of the week it is. So that's a problem.
Yeah. The other big piece of news I saw this week, which, you know, big to some, not to others. I mean, again, I think a lot of people on this podcast that listen to the show would much rather we focus on what's happening with the really cool boutique craft growers or very specific parts of the industry. And sometimes we get into the macro of what's happening with these big Wall Street companies. But Merida, which is a private equity fund run by my buddy Mitch Berukowitz, just did de-SPAC a SPAC that used Leafly as its combination company. So it married the capital from the SPAC with Leafly as the qualifying transaction, and they actually just de-SPAC'd it. So congrats to the Merida team and to Mitch for getting that done. And Leafly now is a public company. So, you know, when you think privateer bought that company for, what, $7 million back in 2014, was there, you know, just getting out of the gate before privateer became, like, the big company, before Tilray, before any of that, before Marley Natural, the first thing they do is buy Leafly. And, you know, now Leafly is a standalone, you know, media giant in the cannabis industry. That and, you know, MJ Biz and Weed Maps are probably the three that have really, you know, made good in this space. But that's a, you know, as a media announcement, that's a pretty big one.
It is a pretty big one. And, you know, maybe that'll change people's perceptions of, you know, Leafly. And you know, I'm guilty of it. You know, the only time I'm on Leafly is when I'm looking up a strain. And, you know, it'll give me a pretty good idea of, you know, usually what kind of strain I have and what type of effects I can expect, whether, you know, indica, sativa, any of that. And I appreciate that for what it is.
But they killed that game. You know, like, they're the ones that actually got out there and said, what information do people want? And every strain cross you can think of in the world is sitting on that site. Whether or not they've gotten every genetic right, they've certainly done, like, the best they can, like, from, like, a Wikipedia perspective of trying to get out there and speak to the genetics guys and find out, like, what is the genesis of this strain? What are the crosses that got us to where it is? And they've, I mean, like, that's no easy task to actually get that shit right.
And you said it exactly. I couldn't have said it better. It is like a Wikipedia thing, right? Where, you know, I should know better, but I still thought, you know, I'll Wikipedia says this, okay, and I'll run with it. But you know, that's exactly what it is, and it's nice to see, and I love that about them. You know, I use that and weed maps, although I find you don't really need weed maps very much anymore, at least my personal experiences, because most of the time you can, it's not hard to find the dispensaries anywhere.
Yeah, it used to be ICMAG was the other like place you'd go for like, you know, breeders discussing stuff with breeders. You know, if you want sort of the Silk Road of information among growers, you know, that was always a good place to turn to for, you know, tips on extraction, tips on cultivation. But even that, you know, like there's no really need for underground. You know, it's at this point, it's up out in the open. If you want to exchange ideas, you know, no one's worried about the man knocking your door down anymore. So, you know, good for Leafly for kind of finding that niche early, and, you know, good for Weed Maps and for some of these other groups doing the same thing. And obviously, like, none of them would be here, like literally none of them, but for High Times, you know, from, you know, the 70s forward. So, you know, again, I think people always need to remember kind of who to pay the debt of gratitude to. And in this case, you know, cannabis media, there's only one. It starts and ends with High Times.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, it's very important for those of us who grew up in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, High Times was our first, you know, experience into, you know, anything other than all the whispered rumors about drugs and this and that. You get a copy of High Times magazine, you could go check it out. You look at the centerfold, you know, and although ironically enough, I'm sure my mother would have probably been more upset of me looking at a centerfold of High Times than she would have been looking at a centerfold of Playboy magazine.
They're both sexy.
Yeah, well, sometimes they were. There's no doubt about that. I certainly can't disagree with that. But yeah, I would agree with you about High Times, and it is important to remember those folks and the people who really got it started for the rest of us, and they've been there from the beginning. So. That's great, too. Well, Rob, this has just been a great show. Jay's a great guest. We've got a great guest lined up next week, Scott Berman from the Panther Investment Fund. It's going to be a little more business-focused, but...
Scare our listeners off. Next week is going to be the best episode you've ever heard. Don't miss it.
That's what they were saying about Bob Weir and Jay, right? The next picture. And you're absolutely right. It's just a different... It'll be a different focus next week. But Scott is also a big Deadhead, so I'm sure he'll have lots of good Grateful Dead stories to share with us as we all do from time to time when we get together and have a chance to go over. And music-wise... you know, great selection for today, Rob. This is I think a lot of people's you know, in their top five, certainly in mine, and one of the very first bootleg tapes that I got that I wore out listening to my senior year at Michigan in 1983, every road trip we went on, every time we were sitting around getting high. Boom, that tape went in.
Well, Dan, Larry, you're giving me a lot of crap. I'll tell Dan. Larry's giving me credit for a show that he pretty much picked out and said, what do you think about this one? I just endorsed it. So thank you for giving me the credit. What I will say is I did spring, you know, one other thing we're going to listen to before we head out today, which is something I don't think you'd ever heard before, Larry, which is K-San's 1972 recording of Garcia and Merle, which actually has Bill Kreutzmann playing in, on the recording as well. But K-San in San Francisco, once in a while, would get artists into their studio, into the actual, like, you know, recording studio within the FM broadcast station, and would put different bands on to play, you know, stuff for the audience in San Francisco. And they got some fantastic artists over a period of time. But in this particular time, this is just when Jerry and Merle Saunders were getting together, and they played about 10 songs, I think, in the Pacific High Studios, which is, you know... First of all, I love FM recordings. Absolutely love them because they're so fat, right? They just have that really, really fat sound. And also, you know, this is one of the first times you got to hear what was, you know, going to become just an amazing collaboration for the next, you know, 7 or 8 years. But you know, when I set this one over for you to listen to, I was really surprised when you came back and said that you hadn't heard it. And super stoked. I mean, it's the 50th anniversary. We missed it last week. We should have put it on last week's podcast. But February 5th, 1972... was when this recording was, and it starts off with just a terrific, it takes a lot to laugh, takes a train to cry, despite the fact they played the last verse first and then came back to it, a super, super funky expressway, a great That's the Touch I Like, and then a couple random ones, like Save Mother Earth, which I never heard them play after that, and then they played John Lennon's Imagine instrumentally, which is just absolutely beautiful. As we head out today, I think we're listening to a piece of that, but then some more Elvis with That's All Right Mama, and then Who's Loving You Tonight, some more dealing with it when I pay my masterpiece, then I Was Made to Love Her, Lonely Avenue, and How Sweet It Is to finish it off. So 11 tracks. I think they've actually, you know, put it out there in some sort of bootleg tape at one point, but if anyone out there has not heard it, this is one that you should definitely be looking up. So again, it's Pacific High Studios, February the 5th, 1972. And I know you had a chance to listen to it, Larry.
I did, and it's fantastic. And that's a great introduction to it. And I think this is probably a good time to let everyone know that although there's more Grateful Dead than we could possibly ever imagine listening to and talking about in an entire lifetime, Rob and I have been talking for a long time about starting to focus a little bit on the Jerry Garcia Band. I'm sure it's no surprise to anyone who listens to this show that Rob and I are both huge fans of the JGB. And this is a great opportunity to listen to it. But I would really, really urge our listeners in particular to tune in 2 weeks from now because we're going to be featuring a Jerry Garcia show from Keene College back in 1980 that I think many people, you know, will look at as one of the great Jerry Garcia Band shows of all time.
Eleanor Rigby After Midnight, Eleanor Rigby. Or After Midnight, Eleanor Rigby After Midnight.
Which alone is the reason to buy it, but the whole thing is just so good. And in fact, the Dead released it commercially a few years, well, not the Dead, I guess, the Garcia family, whoever releases Jerry's stuff. And that's been released for a little while now, but you can get it from Keene College. And it's just wonderful. So for people who are particularly interested in listening and talking about Garcia, be sure to be listening 2 weeks from now.
Yeah. And then before we go to all our fish friends out there, Trade has announced 4 dates for TAB. So 2 nights in Boston, 2 nights in Colorado, 1 at Red Rocks, and 1 up at the Gerald Ford Amphitheater. So if you're in Colorado and you haven't had a chance to see that venue yet up in Vail, get your tickets as soon as you can, because that's a fantastic place to see a band. Same place that, you know, the Jerry Garcia Birthday Band played a couple of years ago. I've seen some great shows there. I know the Wolf Brothers played there last summer. But, you know, one of my favorite venues, and Colorado's got so many of my favorite venues, but I'd say, you know, between that and State Bridge and Red Rocks and Mishawaka, you know, there's a handful of just, you know, Telluride, Town Park, some really special places in that state to see music, and the Gerald Ford Amphitheater is definitely one of them. So happy to see that announcement.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to sign off, Rob, and then I'm going to let you take us home with the Garcia fine, and I'm just going to sit back and listen to it. So to all of our listeners, thank you very much for listening today. Have a great week and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Rob?
We'll see you all next week with another fun show. Thanks to Jay Blakesburg for being on with us. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Dan Humiston. And this is a little bit of the instrumental Imagine from Pacific High Studios on February 5th, 1972. So with that, we'll see you next week. Looking forward to lots of fun shows coming up, and signing off here from California.